let's go ahead for time's sake. Let's go ahead and get started. So this is the anxiety for depression and anxiety, speaking of being anxious, this is the seminar for depression and anxiety. My name is Jamie Rhodes. I'm the campus minister at USC, and I'm really just going to kind of dive right in. I hope you have a handout. The handout's pretty thorough, as thorough as a depressed person can make a handout. And so this is going to kind of be our guide for the next 2 days. Let me just say two things as we get started, just by way of introduction. First is I wanted to say a little bit about the seminar and my approach to the seminar. And here's what I want to say, is that basically we're going to talk about depression and anxiety, but we're going to talk about them together. So I know some of you are here and depression is more your story, and that's more my story, so I'm going to talk a lot about that. But increasingly, doctors and psychologists are starting to actually call it depression anxiety, and they're actually treating it both together. And they're kind of thinking about it as two sides of the same coin, that those of us who are very anxious are also very depressed, and sometimes those of us who are very depressed can also get very anxious. So I'm really going to kind of talk about them together and treat them as two sides of the same coin. If you would like for me to say more or share a little bit more about anxiety, if that's more your struggle, please don't hesitate. Let me say this just from the start. Part of why I love to do this seminar is that this is a very personal for me. John Stone, if those of you who know him, has said two things about me that really, I remember them and they like cause great shame. One of them is, he would say, most campus ministers think Sammy feels. I'm like, okay, I feel shame with that. The other one was that when meeting with my wife and I one time, he said, Sammy, you're the emotional woman of your relationship, which caused more shame. But basically, part of why I love, this is the second year that I've taught this seminar, part of why I love to teach it is this is very personal for me. I have wrestled with depression, anxiety since really as long as I can remember, but especially from my middle school years, at certain points in my story, and I'm going to kind of share my story. This is going to be way more personal than it is theoretical. We're going to talk some theory, but at points in my life, I've contemplated suicide. There are points in my life where friends and my wife have looked at me with that sort of frustration of, what's wrong with you? Why can't we seem to help you? Why can't you just stop being Eeyore and be Tigger for a little while? And so I'm going to kind of share my story throughout this. But I want to just, that's by way of introduction, I want to pray for us, and then I'll kind of tell you where we're going in this handout. By the way, Les Newsom is going to take some pictures, so don't mind the we have a photographer, which is incredible. So welcome him, let him do his thing. But let me pray for us, and then we'll go ahead and dive into the handout. Father, we thank you for your word, and even as we've heard this week already, that it is to us a lamp unto our path, a guide unto our feet. Lord, I thank you for what you say for those of us who often feel these feelings that overwhelm us, we don't know what to do with, and we feel weak. We feel anxious. We feel depressed. And Lord, I thank you for your word from Isaiah that when you tell us that a bruised reed you will not break and a faintly burning wick you will not quench. And Lord, my prayer for me and for my friends is that increasingly in this time together this week that you would show us your heart for those of us who struggle in this way, that you are not frustrated with us, that your heart goes to us. You love us deeply more than we know. And I pray more than anything this week that our view of you would change and soften, and that we would see that you really are the wonderful counselor who really does have incredible grace, unspeakable grace for us, and meets us with gentleness and tenderness. And I pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. All right, so here's kind of the map, so to speak, of where we're going this week. Four things. You see it up there. By the way, if you have questions, we're going to save about 10 minutes at the end to do some question and answer. So feel free to text questions. That is my number, so please take it kind of seriously. But feel free to do that. But here's where we're going. Today we're going to talk about, when we think about depression and anxiety, we're thinking about four things together in these 2 days. We're thinking first about the condition, just what it feels like to wrestle with this. So some of you are going to really relate to it, and some of you have friends that you need to understand this is how they feel. So first, the condition. Second, today, we're just doing the first two today. Second, the complexity. We're going to talk about a lot of different approaches and the way that Christians for a long time have thought about it and still think about it. And I'm kind of got to give you my view on it. And then tomorrow, we're going to talk about its causes and its cures. So thinking about where does it come from and what can we do about it. But today, we're kind of going a little bit more big picture. And then tomorrow, we're getting a little bit more practical about what do you do if this is your struggle or you have a friend who's struggling in this way. But first, think with me for a little bit, and really I'm going through this handout, so this is hopefully going to be helpful for you. But first, I want to talk about how it feels. And these are, over the years, some quotes just from all over the place, from people from like Spurgeon to people who, like, if you're an English person, Jeffrey Eugenides, I think that's how you say it, which is an incredible name, but from his book, The Marriage Plot. But these are some of the most helpful. We're trying to put words around what does it feel like to have depression, anxiety. So let me just read a couple of these and just read them along with me. So here's the first. This is from a book called The Marriage Plot. And here's how one of the characters describes his wrestling with depression. He says this. He says he felt as if he were being violently emptied out. And I love this description. As if a big magnet were pulling his blood and fluids down into the earth. He was weeping again, unstoppably, his head like the chandelier in his grandparents' house, the one that was too high for them to reach, and that every time he visited had one fewer bulb alight. His head was an old chandelier going dark. And then listen to the way another character says it. They're in an addiction group, and this one character says it like this. She says, "One thing I learned between addiction and depression, depression a lot worse. Depression ain't something you just get off of. You can't get clean from depression. Depression be like a bruise." I love this description. "Be like a bruise that never goes away. A bruise in your mind. You just got to be careful not to touch where it hurts. It'll always be there, though." Or listen to the way that, this is why I love the Psalms, by the way. We're going to talk a lot this week about the Psalms. And there's an incredibly helpful book in the bookstore called Cry of the Soul, and looking at how the Psalms give us a biblical way of thinking before God about all kinds of different emotions. One of those emotions being feeling down, just feelings of depression and worthlessness. And here's one of my favorite Psalms in all of the Bible is Psalm 88. I mean, it really is like the Coen brothers did a Psalm, because it's like dark, 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 dark. And then typically in the Psalms, there's a turn like, but God, you are this, or but God, you've promised this. But in Psalm 88, it's dark, 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 dark. And it leaves us at dark. It leaves us like Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, which we're going to talk about. Because part of you are here and you feel shame about your depression. And part of me is trying to convince you that Jesus actually felt depression and anxiety in the garden. We're going to talk about that later. But Psalm 88 is a picture of saying the Bible knows what to do with this. There are people who love God and yet feel this depressed. And here's what the psalmist says. He says, "O Lord, why do you cast my soul away? Why do you hide your face from me? Afflicted and close to death from my youth up, I suffer your terrors. I am helpless." You ever felt that way? God, where are you? If you are real and the gospel produces joy, why do I feel this way? And why don't you change this way that I'm feeling? Have you ever wrestled with that? The Bible does. But then here's one of my very favorite ones. This is actually, if you know anything about David Foster Wallace, by the way, get on the old Google machine. And if you want to hear the most incredible senior commencement speech that I've ever read, David Foster Wallace did one probably in the late 90s. But it's the most brilliant thing I've ever listened to from a non-Christian about idols, especially. But Foster Wallace was a writer, but he struggled with severe depression to the point where he took his life in the early 2000s in a really sad way. He wrote his greatest book was Infinite Jest, which is about 1,000 pages long, and you will be depressed if you even try to read it. But here's what he says in this little article about depression, and he calls it the bad thing. And this is, for me, incredibly helpful, so just read it along with me. We're trying to put words around what depression feels like. So listen to the way Foster Wallace says it. He says, "Because the bad thing, depression, anxiety, not only attacks you and makes you feel bad and puts you out of commission, it especially attacks and makes you feel bad and puts out of commission precisely those things that are necessary in order for you to fight the bad thing. to maybe get better, to stay alive. So here's what he's saying. This is what I've always wrestled with in my Christian life about depression. Am I depressed because I'm not doing or doing certain things? Or am I not doing or doing certain things because I'm depressed? It's like the chicken and the egg thing. And here's what Foster Wallace says. He says, "This is hard to understand, but it's really true. Imagine a really painful disease that, say, attacked your legs and your throat and resulted in a really bad pain and paralysis and all-around agony in these areas. The disease would be bad enough, obviously, but the disease would also be open-ended. You wouldn't be able to do anything about it. Your legs would be all paralyzed and, I'm just going to quote him, would hurt like hell, but you wouldn't be able to run for help for those poor legs, just exactly because your legs would be too sick for you to run anywhere at all. Your throat would burn like crazy and you think it was just going to explode, but you wouldn't be able to call out to any doctors or anyone for help precisely because your throat would be too sick for you to do so. This is the way the bad thing works. It's especially good at attacking your defense mechanisms. The way to fight against or get away from the bad thing is clearly just to think differently, to reason and argue with yourself, just to change the way you're perceiving and sensing and processing stuff. But you need your mind to do this. Your brain cells with their atoms and your mental powers and all that, yourself. And that's exactly what the bad thing has made too sick to work right." You see what he's saying? Part of the struggle of depression is you need to get your mind right. But how do you get your mind right when your mind's not right? You see that? We're going to talk a lot more and work that out a little bit later. But we're putting words around depression. Look at these last two. These always inspire me because I'm like, oh, Abraham Lincoln, he was a great guy. He also wrestled with depression, crippling depression. Here's what he said. He said, "I am now the most miserable man living. If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. Whether I shall ever be better, I cannot tell. Awfully forebode I shall not. To remain as I am is impossible. I must die or be better, it appears to me." And then, of course, one of my heroes, Spurgeon. Listen to the way Spurgeon says it. He says, "Causeless depression cannot be reasoned with, nor can David's heart charm it away by sweet discoursings. As well fight with the mist as with this shapeless, undefinable, yet all-beclouding hopelessness." Whenever he says that, if you're a Lost fan, I like to imagine the smoke monster in Lost. I'm not sure that's what Spurgeon had in mind. But the iron bolt which so mysteriously fastens the door of hope and holds our spirits in gloomy prison needs a heavenly hand to push it back. This is what it feels like to wrestle with depression and anxiety. But now you think with me for a little bit about what it affects. And this is where we're starting to get a little bit more into our lives. What does it affect about us? And I think it affects actually three things. You can see it there. I think it affects our feeling, our thinking, and our doing. Okay, this is how we're going to look at what does depression and anxiety affect? Well, everything. It affects our feeling and our thinking and our doing. So first, think with me about how it affects our feelings. And what it does is it brings about overwhelming feelings, and here are just a few of them. First is sadness. Just an overwhelming feeling of just being sad. Here's the way William Cooper put it. He's one of my favorite hymn writers, just getting into this idea of sadness. He says, "I was struck with such a dejection of spirits as none but they who have felt the same can have the least conception of. Day and night I was upon the rack, lying down in horror and rising up in despair, I presently lost all relish for those studies to which before I had been closely attached. The classics had no longer any charms for me. I had need of something more salutary than amusement, but I had not one to direct me where to find it." We're listening to the song. It's in Psalm 42. "My tears," it's like he's been listening to Bon Iver, "my tears have been my food day and night. My soul is cast down within me." So here's part when I think about this. This is the moment in my life that I think about. And when I think about this moment, it's one of the sadder, more shameful moments for me. And I can remember it was my junior year of high school. And typically, when you're in high school, I don't know what it was like for you, but for me in my high school group, like, it's a Friday night. You're supposed to be out with your friends. Like, you're supposed to be out doing something. Maybe you're going to a party, you're going to a movie. Where for us, I grew up in a little town called Sumter, South Carolina, and the only restaurant we had was Applebee's, which might explain why I wrestled with depression. But so we would always go to Columbia to like go to the big restaurants. We thought TGI Fridays was like amazing because they had this build your own burger deal, which looking back, it's just, I feel sad for myself. But but I can remember this one Friday night, and this is when VH1 was still around, and this is when Counting Crows was still a band. And you've probably never heard of Counting Crows, but they used to have some of the most depressing kind of breakup music. And I remember this, I vividly remember this. So I remember it was a Friday night, and for whatever reason, I decided to stay at home by myself. Red flag number one. Red flag number two is I was watching this Counting Crows concert again by myself, and I just was like weeping. So I'm like looking at her, and I can look at that and be like, "What was wrong with like what's wrong with me?" And I remember thinking, like, I remember thinking at the time, like, "What's wrong with me?" I was, on the one hand, incredibly sad for no reason, and yet the other hand, incredibly drawn to sad things. And some of you can totally relate to that. So you're often drawn to sad things, or you feel sad for no real reason. It's just a feeling that is often there for you. But not only sadness, sometimes it's anger. And I think when we talk about anger, it's interesting because I don't mean the kind of anger that's, it can be explosive. I've certainly had in my life moments of explosive anger. But I think for those of us who are depressed and anxious, oftentimes it's more what I like to call crockpot anger. You ever cooked in the crockpot versus powder keg anger? Powder keg anger is, it blows up. Crockpot anger just kind of simmers. Just sort of always underneath the floorboards of your life is this sort of simmering anger. If you watch Breaking Bad at all, I think Walter White is this kind of character where just beneath, there's always this quiet kind of simmering anger. And I think it means the way that you know what are some of the signs for you, it means you easily feel resentment. You easily are irritable over like the kind of dumb things. And there's this, I think it's going to especially be true of guys who struggle with depression and anxiety. There's just sort of this simmering crockpot anger kind of beneath the surface. But then also there are feelings of worthlessness. So feelings of sadness, of anger, but also of worthlessness. And here's the best way that I think I could describe it is that you, on the one hand, you long, as Scott was saying last night, you long to be fully known and fully loved. And yet you are incredibly skeptical that that could ever be true of you. That anyone could ever really know you and love you. And so you constantly feel worthless. That not even God could fully know you and love you. I often think about the scene in Good Will Hunting, which is one of my favorite movies, where you remember the scene where Skylar and Will, and Skylar's told Will she's moving to California, and Will does that thing where he's scared. She's like, "Move with me." And he's like, "You don't want me to move with me because if you knew who I really was, you wouldn't want to be around me. We're just going to get to California." You remember this scene? "You're just going to get to California, and as soon as we get there, you're going to leave me because you're going to see who I really am, and you're not going to want to stick around." And so that, a lot of us who wrestle with this feel worthless. We feel unloved and unlovable. And that it's kind of weird that nothing can kind of pierce through that. And we long for something to pierce through it. The story that I think about a lot is my daughter. And so what we do sometimes in that is we look for things to make us worthy. We look for things that make us stand apart. So the story that I think about a lot is my daughter. One of the things I love about RUF is I get to do a lot of weddings. And so a couple years ago, we were doing this wedding, and my oldest daughter, who's sort of, we're cut from the same cloth. I'm an introvert. She's an introvert. But she's got this thing. We're not cut from the cloth in this way. She loves to dance. I don't love to dance because I'm just not my gift. But she loves to dance. She's doing ballet and all this stuff. And so when we go to weddings, she's like it's my nightmare to be the first person on the dance floor. But like my daughter is like out there. She's like, you know, dancing and like putting in the moves. And so we're at this wedding a couple years ago, and my daughter heads to the dance floor. She's dancing. She's doing her thing. And it's kind of scary because she's got, like, stripper moves. And I'm like, whoa. I am raising, hopefully not a stripper. But then she's on the dance floor. But then these older girls come out on the dance floor, and, like, they really know what they're doing. So my daughter's, she's 8 now, and these girls are, like, 12. And they're, like, really dancing. And my daughter just melts down. Like, literally, she crumples to the dance floor. She's watching these other girls dance. She's just like, got these, like, she's got lasers for eyes. She's just pissed. And as we get in the car to go home, my you know, I finally say, Jane Mack's her name, and I say, Jane Mack, you know, what's wrong? And she goes, she's fighting back. She goes, those girls. I hate those girls. They're better dancers than me. And in that moment, I see myself and I see us longing for something to make us feel okay about ourselves and yet never quite being able to find it. And all the while, we can put it in these terms, the Lord, it's like the older brother in Luke 15, the Lord has invited us into the party with him, and yet we're constantly trying to find worth apart from him. One of the ways you fight worthlessness, we're going to talk more about this tomorrow, but one of the ways you fight worthlessness, the main way you fight worthlessness is to know that you are worth it to Jesus and that your worth comes from his love for you, not something that sets you apart among your peers. But let's keep moving. So two more feelings that sometimes overwhelm you when you're thinking about depression and anxiety. One is panic. And I think particularly if you feel like you wrestle on the side of anxiety, panic is often the feeling. A lot of you have wrestled with panic attacks, and I can't exactly relate to that, but from the friends that I know and love that have told me about it, it really is in the same way as a depressed person feels like they can't get out of bed. Often those of you who have wrestled with panic attacks, you melt down and you don't know what to do about it, and you feel paralyzed. And that's the word. You don't know how to not feel anxious. And so you feel paralyzed. These anxious feelings rise up like a balloon or like a glass, you know, when you've gone to like one of those incredible fountain machines and like you fill it up and it spills over the side. This anxiety is how it feels and you feel paralyzed by it. I like the way that Bright Eyes puts it when he says it like this. He says, when panic grips your body and your heart's a hummingbird, raven thoughts blacken your mind until you're breathing in reverse. All your friends and sedatives mean well but make it worse. Every reassurance just magnifies the doubt. Better find yourself a place to level out. Got a cricket for a conscience, always looks the other way. The cocaine soul starts seeming like an empty cabaret. Hey, where have all the dancers gone? Now the music doesn't play. Tried to listen to the river, but you couldn't shut your mouth. Better take a little time to level out. Another way of saying it, that one of the books that, that I'm using here says that this helpful for me, is that in anxiety, the person often, we often overestimate the threat or danger they're facing, and at the same time usually underestimates their own capacity, or we could say Jesus' capacity, to cope with the problem. You see that? That's part of how anxiety works. Depression, too, is you're constantly overestimating the threat or overestimating the danger and underestimating your capacity, and especially as someone belonging to God, his capacity and his promises to deal with it. That's why I love, though, Elijah, and if you know the story from 1 Kings 19, it's a sweet story. If you've never, if you are someone who wrestles with this and you don't know that story, I really do encourage you to go read it today, especially to that idea of the way the Lord meets us in this struggle. Because here's, and I'm not going to go into the whole thing, but the basic short story is Elijah is on the run, and he's incredibly depressed, and he's incredibly heartbroken, and he goes to this cave. He's deeply anxious. He can't see a way forward, and the Lord, in the most tender way, feeds him. And we're going to talk a lot more how we over-spiritualize this. But this story is the story for me, how the Lord meets those of us who struggle in this way with tenderness and grace and helps us, in the words of Bright Eyes, to level out. But the last feeling that sometimes we have is the feeling of suicide. Here's the way that we think about it. Sometimes we grow so weary of being burdened and being a burden that killing yourself seems like the only thing to do. Thoughts of suicide, threats of suicide, attempts at suicide. You hope has really flickered out. And some of us have gotten to points where we really don't see another way forward other than taking our lives. You know, just for my own life, I got to this place especially. There were two places in my life where suicide were really big for me. One was before I was a Christian in middle school. Part of my story, and some of you guys know this from USC, and some of you guys maybe have heard me say this before, but part of my story, and we're going to talk more about causes tomorrow, but part of my story is my dad left home in a very tragic way when I was in seventh grade. The long story short is my dad, through multiple affairs and nursing a cocaine habit, ended up getting addicted to crack and left my mom for another woman who they both sort of discovered crack together. And so for about age 12 to about age 22, my dad was really out of my life. He was in and out of rehab. And so, like a lot of you, I have deep father wounds. So many of us have deep father wounds, whether it was abandonment or abuse, or just, you know, I don't know what it was for you. But I can remember in that time just not seeing a way forward and thinking often and talking with friends often about killing myself. And then I became a Christian, and the joy of the Lord was sweet for a long time. But then when I got to college, those feelings and I think depression in a major way kind of came back with a vengeance. And I can remember a pretty good one moment my junior year where, I was the guy that was kind of the crazy boyfriend. Let's just put that on the table. There are a lot of times the crazy girlfriend, but I was the crazy boyfriend who was, especially in high school, incredibly possessive and controlling, and even in college with my wife, could be incredibly possessive and controlling. And I remember this one time, my wife had come to visit my family, and she was staying with us. And I remember, for whatever, like literally, I'm just going to be very honest here, I remember getting insanely jealous that my wife was talking to my sister. And somehow in my mind, I'm just putting it on the table and trying to be honest, in my mind I thought, I can't handle this. And so I literally left a suicide note, got in my car, and drove. And after about 2 or 3 hours, came back to my house. The cops were there, which was a humbling moment. My wife, girlfriend then, and my mom were looking throughout the house to see if I'd taken one of my stepfather's guns. That was a moment for me that was kind of like, okay, something's wrong. And in a lot of ways, that pushed me to counseling, and which has been a big theme I'm going to talk a lot about in my life, and I think will always be a theme in my life, and I think should be a theme in all of your lives, but we'll talk about that more tomorrow. Why do I say that? I say that to say you can be a Christian and wrestle with suicide. I long for you, if that's you, especially today, I long for you to please talk to your campus minister. Part of why I love RUF and doing RUF is that, and I think this is why you guys like RUF, is that your campus minister, he knows he needs Jesus. He knows he's more broken than you. And you can take things like that to him and to his wife and to your interns, and they can know how to meet you in an appropriate way. So please, please, please hear me. Please, if that's you, please. I would love to talk to me, talk to your campus minister, talk to your interns, and let's start talking through this together. But Spurgeon himself wrestled in this way. Look at what he said. Two things. He said this, two quotes. He said, "Death would be welcome as a relief to those whose depressed spirits make their existence a living death. Are good men ever permitted to suffer thus? Indeed, they are. And some of them are even all their lifetime subject to bondage, feeling as if even God himself had quite forgotten him." And look at the other one. He says, "It's all very well for those who are in robust health." This is especially if you are here and you do not wrestle with this, but you have friends or students who wrestle with this. Listen to this one. "It is all very well for those who are in robust health and full of spirits to blame those whose lives are sicklied or covered with the pale cast of melancholy." It's an old-fashioned word for depression. "But the malady is as real as a gaping wound, and all the more hard to bear because it lies so much in the region of the soul that to the inexperienced it appears to be a mere matter of fancy and diseased imagination." And listen to what he says. This is Charles Spurgeon. He says, "Reader, never ridicule the nervous and hypochondriacal. Their pain is real, though much of the malady lies in the imagination or the thought processes. It is not imaginary." And this is, for me, what began changing the way I thought about this was not only my own story, but we had a dear friend in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I went to seminary, who once we moved on and did RUF at Georgia Southern for a few years. This was probably 3 years ago. This is a guy who we knew a little bit about his struggle with depression. We knew he'd been a little bit in and out of hospitals. But one day, his wife had just taken the kids out, and he went into the backyard, and he just ended it all. And that for me is when I thought, and I'm going to talk about this in just a few minutes, but that is for me when I thought, this is more than just sin to be repentant of. You have to see that. That this is something that is so much bigger than just the spiritual sphere. That this is something that we don't exactly know everything about it, but I can tell you this, that it is a very painful condition that we experience as broken human beings living in a broken world. And please, please don't belittle it. So first, it affects our feeling, but now think with me how it affects our thinking and our doing. And we're going to kind of fly through these a little bit because I want to get to the complexity. But think about how it affects your thinking. So if you're wrestling with depression and anxiety, here's how it affects your thinking. And those of you who wrestle can relate to this. First, you think in extremes. You're given to all or nothing thinking. You either have to be a complete success or you're an utter failure. I love the way Kevin Twitt sometimes talks about the defeated perfectionist. That defeated perfectionists should all over themselves. That we're constantly shooting all over ourselves because we think we should be this or we should be that or we should have done this or we shouldn't have done that. And we just should all over ourselves all the time. That's part of how it affects our thinking. Thinking about the way that Anne Lamott put it. By the way, I've got a book recommendation list. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. This book, strangely, it's a book on writing, but when I was super depressed about 4 years ago, this book, more than anything, really just helped me. I'm just sharing that. I don't know if it would help you in the same way, but mainly because she's got a sense of humor. You know, part of what I long for our FTB is we learn to love Jesus and laugh at ourselves. And I think if you wrestle with depression and anxiety, you've got to learn to laugh at yourself. You've got to. And here's what she says. She says, I think perfectionism is based in the obsessive belief that if you run carefully enough, hitting each stepping stone just right, you won't have to die. The truth is that you will die anyway, and a lot of people who aren't even looking at their feet are going to do a whole lot better than you and have a whole lot more fun while they're doing it. So thinking in extremes, all or nothing, right? Here's the second way it affects your thinking, is it gives you what I call, what Ed Welch calls, depression's odd filter. Everything everyone says gets filtered by shame, okay? It's like the video game character, and you sort of, you know, sometimes in those old, like, Legend of Zelda, you probably never played Zelda, I'm dating myself, but you know the games, whatever, Halo, whatever you play, whatever first-person shooter games you guys play these days, which are the worst, because I suck at them. But you get the shield, and, like, nothing can get through the shield. That's how this kind of works, is there's, like, when someone tries to encourage you, or say something nice to you, like it's a shield, it just blocks it. It's like you're an X-Men character, and that's your gift, is you're like blocking encouragement, right? Like no encouragement can get through to you because you've got your, you know, you've got this shield. Listen to the way that Ed Welch says it. He says this. He says someone, he's talking about this filter. He says, by the way, Google this, depression's odd filter, it's incredible. I think I've got a weird footnote on it that you can notice. But he says, someone says to you, I love you. You hear nothing. Actually, you hear something. You hear a little voice in your brain that says, I'm worthless. You're only saying you love me because you think you have to. Somehow, from the mouths of other people to your ear, all words of blessing and encouragement get tumbled upside down and backward and confirm your suspicions about yourself. You are an abject failure, unloved, unlovable, and everyone knows it. There are hundreds of variations. You look nice today. Push it through the filter of depression and you get, not true, I know I'm ugly. Or, you seem to be feeling a little better today. This is the worst, by the way. You seem to be feeling a little better today. This means, oh, you don't want to talk to me anymore. This is your brain on depression. And we could add, it is your brain on shame. This is why, for me, part of what's hard about ministry and just preaching is I'm telling you, anytime I preach or teach, or really do anything that someone could comment on, it's the worst. Because anytime anyone says anything encouraging, I'm like, you're just saying that. You don't mean that. In fact, the way that I really think about it, and some of you can relate to this, I really honestly in my mind, like I'm convinced, you're just saying that because you thought it was so bad that you thought I needed to hear you say it was good. Does that make sense? Like, that's how I think. Like, literally, that anytime anyone says anything encouraging, I'm thinking, oh, you just think I'm crappy, so you're trying to say something that makes me feel better. And that's That's messed up thinking. You see that? Like, that's not right. That's why I love when Scott said last night about Mariah Carey, the whole idea of 1,000 praises, but one criticism, right, undoes you, because this is your brain and depression. You don't think it's possible that there's anything actually good in you, that you're made in God's image, that you're worth something. You have gifts. You have gifts that that can be encouraged. So there's a filter. But then there's mind reading and fortune telling. Listen to this one. This is huge for us. Mind reading and fortune telling. You think you know what people are thinking. You think you know how things will play out. You think you know what God knows. And part of the trick is knowing that you don't know what God knows. God alone knows what. I don't know what you're thinking. Like, right now, I would love for you to be thinking great things. I have no idea what you're thinking. God knows what you're thinking. I don't. Truly. But constantly in my life, and you do this too, I think I know what you're thinking. And you think you know what other people are thinking. And part of you, Luther used to say, you have to let God be God. And to know that you're not God. Now, here's the way I love in Anne Lamott's book. She's got this little poem talking about this kind of suspicion, that we're constantly suspicious and paranoid. And listen to this little poem. It's on the bottom of page 4. She says, it's a poem by a guy that she shares in Bird by Bird. He says, "We, who are your closest friends, feel the time has come to tell you that every Thursday we have been meeting as a group to devise ways to keep you in perpetual uncertainty, frustration, discontent, and torture by neither loving you as much as you want nor cutting you adrift. Your analyst is in on it, plus your boyfriend and your ex-husband. And we have pledged to disappoint you as long as you need us. In announcing our association, we realize we have placed in your hands a possible antidote against uncertainty, a deed against ourselves. But since our Thursday nights have brought us to a community of purpose rare in itself, with you as the natural center, we feel hopeful you will continue to make unreasonable demands for affection, if not as a consequence of your disastrous personality, then for the good of the collective." I love that. Yeah, I mean, I really love that. But it also affects your feeling, your thinking. It also affects your doing. Just quickly, simple things are hard. Simple things like going to sleep at a decent hour, or getting up at a decent hour, or just getting a little exercise. Now, part of this is back to the all or nothing thing. So we're going to talk about this more tomorrow, but part of you do, we do unreasonable things. We're like, okay, every night I'm going to be in bed at 10. It's 10:05. Ah, I've blown it, right? Like, we don't think reasonably. We're very all or nothing. I remember a counselor one time said to me, I was telling him how hard it was to get up in the morning. And he was like, "Sammy, it's pretty simple. You just put your feet on the ground and get up." I was like, "I hate you." Like, I never wanted to murder anybody but him. There's an old David Bazan song, "Pedro the Lion," where he says, you're up with the sunrise and down when the work's been done. With excellence, industry, diligence, naturally, I would like to be you just for a few habit-forming years, but laziness cuts me like fine cutlery. I need a miracle, someone to help me myself. Sweet Jesus, I need you. Forgive me the sin. Not hookers or heroin, gambling or gin. It sounds so ridiculous, but I just can't lick this. I need a miracle, someone to help me myself. But you get that. If you've wrestled with depression and anxiety, you get that simple things, for whatever reason, feel impossible. But also there's withdrawal or isolation. This is how it affects our doing. You find it hard, if not impossible, to be in touch, keep in touch with people, to return a text, return a phone call. This is why voicemails are the worst. I wish they were illegal. You no longer go to things. You withdraw, right? This is why, in some ways, I think part of why college is so hard for me is that, my last year I lived alone, partly because I was so depressed, but it was one of the worst things I could have done. As someone who's struggling with depression or anxiety, the last thing you need is to live alone. You're going to want to live alone because you're going to want to withdraw and isolate, but you need safe people who can love you well. I like to think about depressed people as vampires. You know the thing about, in a lot of ways, don't run crazy with this analogy, but you know the thing with vampires is you have to invite them in? You know, you guys know that about vampires? You have to, like, they can't come into your house unless you invite them in. I think it's true for those of you especially who are here because you have friends struggling this way. For those of us who wrestle this way, we need safe people who invite us into things. You know what I mean by safe person? A safe person is someone who gets their own brokenness, but gets that Jesus loves them. And the more you get that, the gentler you will be with people who don't have it together. The gentler you will be with your depressed and anxious friends. Listen to the way Sylvia Plath put it in The Bell Jar. She said, "I wasn't seeing anything, not even myself. I just jumped from hotel to work and to parties and from parties to my hotel and back to work like a numb trolley bus. I guess I should have been excited the way most of the other girls were, but I couldn't get myself to react. I felt very still and very empty, the way the eye of a tornado must feel, moving dully along in the midst of a surrounding hullabaloo." That's what it feels like. That's the condition. Now think with me for just a little bit about the complexity. And here are some of the different approaches. And what I want to do is kind of lay out for you the different approaches, and then I want to lay out for you what I think is my approach, what I hope to persuade you is, for me, the most helpful approach that I've found. But here are some different approaches that that people have kind of thought about thinking about depression. Here's the first. The first I'm just going to call the medical model. And here's what it basically says. It says depression is a disease or sickness that needs to be treated and cured. It's a physical problem similar to a broken bone or cancer, and medicine is the cure. We're actually going to talk more about medicine tomorrow. Listen to this quote, though, from David Murray's "Christians Get Depressed Too." He says, "There is much scientific evidence to support the drug treatment model. Studies have demonstrated that the brains of many depressed patients have a different chemistry and circuitry compared to people with good mental and emotional health. To put it simply, the brain needs chemicals to move our thoughts through, and when these chemicals are depleted, then the whole process slows down or even stops in certain areas." Part of what I want to say before I give you my view is I am convinced of this, and this has changed my thinking in probably the last 3 or 4 years, is I do think the brain is incredibly complex, and I don't think we know near as much about it as we will in years to come. And so part of why, when we talk about the medical model, part of what's a little bit tricky is we have to admit that we think we know some things about the brain, and I think we need to listen as Christians to what people in the medical field are saying about the brain. We'd be foolish not to. But also, I think we're going to know a lot more about the brain in years to come. But let me keep moving before I give you kind of what I think. So second is the emotional model. It basically says that depression is the result of negative emotional experiences, traumas, or wounds. It's an emotional problem caused often by abuse, abandonment, lost and broken relationships, and a broken world. So counseling and therapy is the cure. And I will say this, I think you have to see how the past affects the present. You know, David Jones likes to say that we're all victims and villains. Then on the one hand, we all are villains in the sense that we sin, and we sin against both God and other people, but we also are victims. We also have been sinned against by others, by friends, by family members, by people living in a broken world. And that, we would be insane not to think about how this, the way we've been sinned against, affects the way that we sin. Another way of saying it is we would be foolish not to think about the way the past has affected our present. How our past experiences have impacted our present struggles. This is why and my counselor talks to me all the time about what we call inner room messages. The idea that I have these messages in my mind that sort of say certain things. So like one of my inner room messages going back to my dad is this idea of you can't really trust people. Because when you trust people, they screw you, right? When your dad leaves, who else could leave? Anybody could leave. When your dad leaves, anybody could leave. So part of my inner message, going back to my trauma, is this idea that relationships aren't worth it. Just be by yourself. Isolate, right? We'll talk more about that tomorrow. Then there's the spiritual model. It basically says this: depression is the result of sin. It is a spiritual problem. Repentance is the cure. I want to talk about two streams of this, just as a kind of FYI in the Reformed world, just so you need to know about. One of them is called the Nuthetic Counseling Movement. And here's a couple of things that I think that I disagree with strongly, because I think they heap shame upon shame. But they would say this: the hope for the depressed persons, as elsewhere, lies in this. The depression is a result of the counselee's sin. Listen to another way. This is Jay Adams. He says this. He says, apart from those who had organic problems like brain damage, the people I met were there because of their own failure to meet life's problems. To put it simply, they were there because of their unforgiven and unaltered sinful behavior. Now, I want to speak personally to this. I think if you are someone who wrestles with depression, we're going to make the distinction tomorrow that there are different places that we can say there's a cause of depression that's more circumstantial, and there's a cause of depression that I think is more it's in your constitution. You're sort of always been that way. For those of you who are depressed more sort of by temperament or just by physical whatever is going on in you, this can be incredibly hurtful because you're constantly trying to find a root of your depression that's in your sinful behavior, and I want to tell you that's not always the case. It can be the case. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. It's not always the case. To say that your depression or anxiety is always the result of sinful behavior is utterly simplistic because that is a very, very small view of what we are as human beings and what we experience and what it means to be broken physically, spiritually, and emotionally. In other words, though, depression is almost, they would say, is almost always the result of sinful behavior and failed responsibility. And what I think sometimes if that's all you've ever heard, that heaps shame on you. And it makes you more, ironically, it makes you more depressed. But there's another movement called the Neo-Nuthetic Counseling Movement. Let me just say this. It grew out of the Nuthetic Movement. But it does seek to be less dogmatic and more gospel-centered. Its focus is less on behavior, a little bit more on the heart and idols and the gospel. I think they're incredible. Ed Welch's book, I recommend it, A Stubborn Darkness, is incredibly helpful, although I disagree on his take on medicine. But I would say that this movement doesn't as readily dismiss the medical or the emotional model, but it still puts the emphasis on the spiritual model, especially in the heart and the gospel. But what I want to give very quickly, and I want to do some questions real quick, but I just want to give another way. And this is unashamedly what I think. This is my view. I would love if you disagree. I would love to talk to you about it. But here's what I think, and here's where I've come to in my years of thinking about this. And part of it's rooted in something Martin Lloyd-Jones said, who's one of my heroes in the faith. He said this. He was actually a doctor before he was converted and kind of became a preacher. He said this. He said, many Christian people, in fact, are in utter ignorance concerning this realm where the border lines between the physical, psychological, and spiritual meet. Frequently, I have found that such church leaders had treated those whose trouble was obviously mainly physical or psychological in a purely spiritual manner. And listen to what he says. And if you do so, you not only don't help, you aggravate the problem. So here's what I want to sort of give to you. So you come to me and you say, Sammy, I'm depressed. I'm anxious. What do I do? Do I go see a doctor? Do I go see a counselor? Or do I go see a pastor? And my answer to you is yes. Yep. That a multifaceted approach, that depression is multifaceted, that I think it's all three. Physical components, emotional components, spiritual components. Sometimes, if your depression is more in the circumstantial, we can talk and maybe sometimes pinpoint something that particularly has aggravated it, but I think you've got to keep all three together. That if you're ever going to, that a multifaceted, complex problem requires a multifaceted, complex approach, especially when we come to think about anything like beginning to wrestle and struggle through it. It's not one of the models, but all of the models. It's more theologically robust view of man. It's a more theologically robust view of the struggle. It's not simplistic. It takes into consideration all that we are as human beings, mind, body, and spirit. But regardless of what you think about this is what I'm trying to convince you of. We're going to talk more practically tomorrow. But regardless of what you think about this, here's the helpful principle. Whenever you come to thinking about depression and anxiety, you have to avoid dogmatism and seek humility. You cannot be the person, when the Bible does not speak definitively to a struggle, you cannot be the person who speaks definitively for the Bible about a struggle. We can do this with all kinds of things, but you cannot be that person. If the Bible does not definitively speak to it, you cannot definitively speak to it, right? Listen to the way I'm going to close with this. I'll do some questions. David Murray, by the way, so much of this is from David Murray's little book. It's in the bookstore called Christians Get Depressed Too. It's got a little frowny face with a tear. It's a beautiful little cover. But he says, unfortunately, I'm going to close with this and do some Q&A. He says, unfortunately, Christian preachers and writers have often taken a dogmatic attitude into areas where the Word of God is not dogmatic. One such area is depression or anxiety. I've been frequently shocked by the almost ex cathedra infallibility assumed by Christian writers and speakers when writing or speaking about mental and emotional suffering. It must be admitted that confident, sweeping, dogmatic certainty appeals to us, especially those of us who love Reformed theology. We crave simplicity in a confusing world. However, it is highly damaging in this complex area of depression, which requires careful, balanced, and sensitive thinking. In our study of and in our contact with those suffering from depression or anxiety, let's avoid unfounded and unwarranted dogmatism, and let's study, listen, and speak with humility and an awareness of our own ignorance and insufficiency when faced with the complex and often mysterious causes and consequences of depression. All right, I'm going to stop here and do a couple of question and answers. And let me pull up my phone. And then tomorrow we're going to pick back up on the causes and the cures. I think tomorrow, especially if you're here and you're kind of want to hear more about practically what do you do, tomorrow I think it's going to be more helpful for you. That one was encouraging to just say you're doing a good job, keep it up. Thanks. Okay, here's one. How do you deal with finding comfort? Probably not the right word, but I can't really describe it, in depression. That's a good question. I think I know what you mean by this. One of the most two comforting things for me. One is, and this is why I shared all these quotes, is to think that, and when we think about the cloud of witnesses that Hebrews talks about, there are men like William Cooper, there are men like Charles Spurgeon, Martin Luther, we're going to talk a lot more about tomorrow, who really were very honest about their struggles with depression and anxiety. I had a conversation with a campus minister last night who had an intern who was really wrestling with how do I do ministry as someone who's depressed and anxious. And part of me, in my experience, and I don't mean working with, not myself, but working with other people who wrestle in this way, the Lord, like if you think about Spurgeon, or you think about even William Cooper, like there's some, the Lord certainly uses those of us who struggle in this way in incredible ways in the kingdom. Depressed and anxious people are so many times the most thoughtful, sensitive, caring, and compassionate people. And the Lord, you have to remember that the Lord uses our weakness. There's something powerful when you sit down with a friend and say, listen, I am a broken mess and I need Jesus. And so many times when you struggle with this, it's such a powerful way to do that. The other thing is just thinking about, like I said, the Lord's, just his own, his own view of it. That's why I love a bruised reed he will not break, a faintly burning wick he will not quench. That the Lord himself has a great heart for those of us who struggle in this way. I hope that's some kind of comfort. Here's another one. I'm suffering from depression. I've sought counsel and I'm praying every day and getting close to God. I think I need medicine because I've done almost everything in emotional and spiritual circles. My father will let me see a doctor, nor would he let me in medicine. What should I do? I would love to talk more about this, whoever this is. I'm convinced, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. I'm on Lexapro. I don't say that saying, I think, and Luther says this, I'll quote him tomorrow. I don't think that medicine is a magic bullet. But I do think my own experience, a friend one time said it like this, that a lot of times medicine, if we're talking about that sort of smoke monster from Lost, and you sort of live underneath this cloud of shame and despair and worthlessness, sometimes for me, in that kind of thinking, what medicine has done is it helps me lift my head above the cloud and kind of see things a little more clearly. I think that's true. That's how a friend put it one time. What do you do with a parent who disagrees strongly? I'd love to talk more personally about that, whoever this is. I think I'm always very careful. I think the Lord calls us to honor our parents. I don't think honoring our parents always means that sometimes there are places in our lives where we know we need something, and Jesus is making that very clear, and we have to go against what our parents think. I'm always very cautious. I want to talk through that because sometimes I'm a proudful little idiot who, you know, can go wrong places with that. But I'm convinced, especially if this is a struggle and you've sort of thought through and done counseling around the spiritual and the emotional components, that there's not at all any shame. Part of what I'm trying to do in this seminar is take away the shame. I want to do two things with medicine. I want to take away the shame and the overly spiritualized way we think about medicine sometimes. The way I'm going to say it tomorrow is okay, if I go to a doctor and I say something is wrong with my liver is not working right, he's going to give me medicine. This is how I came to this place. Why can I not say that about my brain? Just because my brain is more complex than my liver, and we don't know as much about the brain as we do about the liver, I still do think the brain is a functioning organ that sometimes cannot be working properly, and medicine sometimes can help that out tremendously. It's not a magic bullet. Luther's going to talk to that. It's not going to solve all your problems, but it can be incredibly helpful. And I'd love to talk with whoever this is more. We've got time for maybe two more. When dealing with friends or students who may be depressed, at what point do we encourage them to seek counseling? And how do we do that without making the person's, great question, making the person in question ashamed / more depressed? Okay, part of what I am trying to do in my group, and I think my group would say this, is I'm trying to take away the stigma of counseling. Listen, we're Christian. Like, part of how you became a Christian is admitting you were messed up. Like, that's how we became Christians. It's like, no, I can't do this. I'm a broken mess. I need Jesus. This means, okay, you could, this is, might be a little over the top, but I really do mean this. I think all of you should be in counseling. Why? Two reasons. Maybe three. One, you're broken. You have brokenness. And even if you don't know what that brokenness is, guess what? Go to counseling and figure out your brokenness. Two, you need to learn to talk about your brokenness. Do you know how to do evangelism? Learn to talk about your brokenness and why you need Jesus. Three, counseling can give you tools. Okay, I get, counseling's not everything. I get that there, like for me, I think my view is that it's for me, I'm get, like it's going to be a constant part of my life. I'm not ashamed of that. I need Jesus. I need someone who can help me think through my brokenness and work through all of these things, especially the trauma, right? Some of you have so many things in your past that you've never talked with anyone about. Counseling can be a wonderful place to learn to talk about your brokenness. How do you say that to a depressed person? That's a good question. Gently. I mean, I think back to the vampire thing, like you've got to make them feel like, you know, they're not alone. That there are people who wrestle in the same way, and that counseling, you know, for me, I think counseling can give a glimmer of not only hope, but tools. So when I talk about thinking, we can do all this. When I talk about feeling, thinking, and doing, we're going to talk about this tomorrow, but we need tools. Like one of the most helpful tools, okay, this is a very small thing from counseling in my life, but I had a counselor say to me one time, because I constantly say things like, ugh, I have to do this. And every time, they would say, you get to do this. You don't have to, you get to. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like that's a bit like small things like that. That's a bad example of a tiny tool that changes the way I think. I don't know why I'm doing this. Sooner the awkwardness of my mannerisms. We got one more. Let me find one. Not sure if I find your mustache incredibly creepy or extremely attractive. Thanks. I sometimes say that having a mustache is incredible until you take your kids to the playground. Let me find one more. Okay, yeah, what if, the last one, what if praying, and we need a break, what if praying for a depressed family member or friend seems completely hopeless? You know, there's a talk, I don't know if you know this or not, but John Piper part of what I love about Piper is he puts all of his stuff, like, for free. Like, everything he's ever written and done, you can just, like, go to Desiring God and find a PDF. He did a talk a couple years back on William Cooper. It looks like Cowper, but it's pronounced Cooper. But and he talked specifically about the way John Newton, who is a pastor that we love, we sang one of his hymns last night. His letters, by the way, are fantastic. If you have, if you're looking for something like a devotional, John Newton's letters are incredible if they have them in the bookstore. But he did a talk specifically on how John Newton ministered to William Cooper. And I think the key words there were patience. And he never made, this is a trick, but he never made William Cooper feel ashamed for his thoughts and feelings. We do that. Have you ever read John Acuff? He's the Stuff Christians Like guy, and he's a funny guy, but he's got that thing called the Jesus Juke, where, like, someone is pouring out their heart to you, and then, like, you just Jesus Juke them. You know, you've ever seen, like, a running back, and, like, all of a sudden they just juke, go the different direction. And I think you got to be really careful with that. And I would just say, hang in there. I mean, sometimes what you need to be, especially if you have friends who are depressed, is you need to be, you need to not be Job's counselors. You remember Job's counselors in the book of Job, where they constantly are looking for some kind of cause, and they're constantly saying to Job, Job, God would not have brought all this suffering into your life if you hadn't done something. And do you remember how God rebukes the crap out of them at the end? When he's like, you know, what I wanted you to do is be more like Jesus and be the wonderful counselor who just listens. And it's just, part of what I love about Jesus is he listens and he's with you. And he's not always looking for the, Jesus himself isn't always looking for the Jesus Jew. Like, okay, how can I get in there and, like, really, you know, I don't know why I'm snapping, but like jazzy Jesus, like, no, get in there and, like, just patience, while at the same time listening way more than speaking. I'm going to stop there. Let me pray for us, and then we'll pick back up tomorrow. Let's pray. Jesus, we thank you for this time. I do pray that as we continue to think through these things, that you would give us your heart and you would give us your mind. You would give us your spirit as we wrestle both with ourselves and with our friends. We pray these things, Lord Christ, in your name. Amen.